And this morning's topic is about defensive asset allocation in an inflationary environment, brought to you by PIMCO. Now, we have a team of experts here, and we've had some fly in to be with us today. And they're going to talk to us about whether we can continue to rely on central banks to win the fight against inflation, or should we look at defensive asset allocation as a way to inflation-proof our portfolios. So I'd like you to please welcome our researcher this morning, Jeff Mitchell from Standard & Poor's. And also please welcome our partner host this morning, who is Peter Dorian from PIMCO. And Peter is now going to introduce you to our speaker.
Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for attending our session. Well, what a difference a year makes. Hands up, how many of you were at the last year's PCF out at Randwick? And of those who were there, hands up who would have predicted that the two best performing asset classes over the past 12 months have been commodities and bonds? Not so many, perhaps. Yeah, it's a very different time that we find ourselves in here at the middle of 2008. And like any good bond manager, what we do is try and think about the gloom and doom, the bad news, the risk scenarios. Now, we've had a lot of these risky scenarios over the last 12 months or so. We've had the credit crisis, the subprime crisis, liquidity crisis. What crisis is left for us to examine in terms of the impact it has on portfolios? Well, here it is, inflation. Inflation is a risk that perhaps many in the room who have joined the industry in the last 10 to 15 years may not really have given great thought to in relation to the impact on portfolios, both at an asset allocation level, but more importantly, at how you actually organise the portfolio in terms of sectors and securities. So today's session is going to examine the implications for asset allocation in the defensive component of a client's portfolio, brought about by what we believe is a sustained rise in inflation around the globe. And to do that today, we're very privileged to have with us a Managing Director of PIMCO, Doug Hodge. Doug has been working with PIMCO for getting on towards two decades now. And he is the person who's responsible for the management of our businesses across Asia, which includes Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, and, of course, Japan. Please join me in warmly welcoming Doug Hodge.
Peter, thank you very much. And I'm going to try not to stand behind the computer, if you don't mind, but I want to welcome you. And if you came here expecting to hear somebody from Putnam, I apologize. They're down the hall somewhere. They'll be back tomorrow, so please bear with us. This is PIMCO, after all. So, crisis, that's a little frightening thought, but what I am going to try and do this morning is take us through the inflationary cycle. And, of course, we've seen some of the ravages, I suppose, that inflation can cause on a portfolio, even in the last year or so. But I'm going to sort of go through the cycle and then page down, guys. There we go. I got it. Take us through the cycle and then try to identify those assets or asset classes which would serve as inflationary hedges as we move through what we believe is the beginning of what could be an inflationary cycle that's in some respects already begun. But before we can look forward, I think it's important that we look back for just a moment. So this chart takes us back through from the beginning of the 1970s, and we came through roughly a 30-year period of declining inflation. And this was brought about through the globalization of financial markets and tradable goods, through the rapid dispersion of productivity-enhancing technologies like communication, the internet, biomedical advances that we've never seen before, and of course, a very large population moving away from a command economy, joining the capitalist economy in Eastern Europe, and then in communist China with the beginning of the open door policy in 1979. And of course, what this did was, as China grew, it really became the emergence of the world's largest factory. And we saw the disinflationary impacts of cheap tradable goods across the entire Western economies, and that's been positive for inflation for almost 30 years. But as we look forward, the emerging economies, while they've been in important growth areas of growth, have also now moved from being exporters of disinflation or deflation to exporters of inflation, and I'll take us through that in a moment. Of course, through that roughly set 30-year period, and certainly for the last 10, we've seen basically an uninterrupted period of economic growth. So we've been in this economic sweet spot of declining inflation and strong economic growth, which is certainly unusual if you look in the post-war period, but it's been a nice place to be. Today, as you look around the world, there's not one major economy in the world whose growth is accelerating, not one. Now, that's not to suggest that we're in recessions everywhere in the world, although some economies it may certainly turn out to be the case, perhaps my own in the United States. But the world is certainly on a slower growth path than it's been in the past. The other thing that's happened is the emergence of the developing world as a driver of economic growth. And looking, and you can see the growth since 2000, where the emerging economies now account for roughly 30% of global GDP. And if you look back over the last 3 years, global growth, 72% of global growth has been the result of the growth in this part of the world, not in the developed world, but in the developing world. So they've been really the engine of global growth for the last 3 years and beyond. And of course, that's led to this divergence of current account surpluses and deficits, as evidenced here. And you can see by the yellow line, the current account balances of the emerging and developing countries, which have been on an ever-rising, almost exponential trajectory, and, of course, the corresponding trade deficits elsewhere. And this has led to this massive, massive accumulation of reserves among central banks, sovereign wealth funds, and the like, which has allowed these developing countries to basically finance their growth and, of course, has caused some of the surge in commodity prices. So we all recognize this guy, right? Here's inflation. So the inflationary pressures we're witnessing, as I think we can all appreciate right here in Australia, are really the spillover from the emerging economies and have been driven in a large part by commodity prices. But there's also come from several sources. Commodity pressures we know about, rising wages in the developing world, most notably in China, but elsewhere as well. The increased social spending among the developed economies. And there's really this, you know, in a democratic and capitalist economy, there's really this conflict between, on one side is the capitalist economy, which is $1, one vote. And in a democratic political system, it's one man, one vote. And the pendulum swings back and forth between the priority of the capitalists, if you will, versus the priority of the voters. And as you look across the Western economies, you've seen the pendulum starting to swing back. And of course, some of the election results even here suggest that, and perhaps what may happen in the United States come November, but certainly is happening in Asia. That tends to lead towards more social spending. History would suggest that tends to cause rising inflationary pressures as well. And of course, part of that, not so much here as perhaps elsewhere in the world, is the depreciation, particularly of the U.S. dollar, causes prices to rise around the world as well. So why should we be worried about inflation? Well, for the simple reason, at the end of the day, the true value of one's savings is ultimately measured in its ability to purchase goods and services. And inflation erodes that purchasing power. I think we all learned that in Economics 101. But it also has pervasive impacts if it remains persistent. It has pervasive impacts and alters the economic patterns of a society, whether it's consumption, business investment, government policies, whether they be fiscal policies and monetary policies, are all influenced by inflation. So how do I protect my portfolio from the ravages of inflation? Well, as we think about this, there's really a range of asset classes that work, and they work through different portions of the inflationary cycle. So what I'm going to do in the remaining time is look at, kind of divide the inflationary cycle into three periods: leading inflation and talk about some of the hedges there, contemporaneous inflation and talk about some of the asset classes that tend to track well during that period of the inflationary cycle, and then lastly, cover lagging inflation hedges. So turning to the leading inflationary hedges, the two that most that tend to come to mind, and these are asset classes whose prices tend to rise before inflation is visible in the broader economy. And the two asset classes that typically come into people's minds are equities and commodities. So let's take a look at each of those in turn. As it turns out, when you go back and look through history, equities don't work very well. The correlation of equity prices to inflation is actually negative through time. And that seems almost counterintuitive. But when you get down into what drives an equity price, right? We kind of all learn discount cash flow analysis. We take the cash flow of a company, we discount it at a certain risk-free rate, and that tells us what the value of the company is worth, and then we extrapolate that into its price by taking that through the P/E ratio, right? So the valuation of that company, there's embedded in every financial asset price is a risk-free rate, whether we're looking at a bond, an equity, some alternative investment, the risk-free rate. Well, if inflation is rising quickly or unexpectedly, that risk-free rate is typically underestimated in our calculus. And that, when we then redo our math and increase the risk-free rate, obviously, we're raising the mathematics of that. We're increasing the denominator in our fraction. That lowers the price. So that's basically what's at work here with regard to equity markets. And we've seen that around the world. The other factor that tends to impede equity prices from keeping track with inflation is that input prices tend to rise faster than final prices, which is the ability to pass through rising costs is hard, particularly in today's world. So that's another reason why equities have tended not to be a good hedge for inflation over time. Whereas you look at commodity prices, you get a different outcome. Commodities are positively correlated with rising inflation, and as you'll see, they tend to work pretty well. They do a couple of things. One is, as suggested, they're positively correlated to inflation. They're also positively correlated to the rate of change of inflation. So as inflation picks up momentum, commodity prices tend to rise at the same speed, unlike perhaps some other classes. They're negatively correlated to sort of the traditional balanced portfolio of equities and nominal bonds. And then lastly, maybe a page out of Jim Rogers' book, over the long horizon, commodity returns have tended to keep pace with economic growth and offered a positive real rate of return. And that tends to make sense. Commodities are one of the important factors of production. If production is rising and economies are growing, then commodity returns ought to be commensurate with that. And indeed, over long horizons, they have been. So let's look at contemporaneous inflation hedges. Now we're in the period where the inflation has moved forward, if you will, in the cycle. We're beginning to see in the economic releases of CPI and producer prices and other economic statistics that inflation is indeed on the rise and has already moved upwards. So now we've kind of moved forward, maybe a year or so into the process. And what works in this kind of environment? Well, this is sort of the more, I would contend, the kind of the more traditional inflationary hedges, which are inflation-linked bonds and other CPI-linked contracts like CPI swaps, and there are other similar instruments that are available in the market. There's also, obviously, Australian inflation-linked bonds, but all of these are relatively scarce. These markets tend to be rather small. I think, as we all know, they're illiquid. So, yes, they work, but it's hard to find sufficient supply to execute your inflation hedging strategy. The one of the markets that is large enough and deep enough to accommodate a contemporaneous inflation hedge is the global inflation-linked bond market. And when you look at the returns of a portfolio of global inflation-linked bonds and its correlation to Australian inflation, it's relatively high. It's certainly positive, and it meets the test. It meets the test for being relevant. And the reason for that is, I think, pretty simple, is the Australian economy is linked into the global economy. So whether it's in the whether it's through the transmission of financial prices or the transmission of real goods, you can see a very tight correlation between global inflation and global inflation-linked bonds and Australian inflation. So how do inflation-linked bonds work? Just the simple mathematics of an inflation-linked bond. And why is it so good? Well, for a simple reason that both the coupon payment, so the income that you're receiving through the passage of time, and your the return of principal are hedged against inflation, are reset as according to some inflationary index, typically the consumer price index or the equivalent. So each period that you receive a coupon payment, the amount of money that you're going to receive is first dependent upon the real yield, which is stated when you buy the instrument. That's what you're protecting, the real yield. If inflation rises, then the coupon payment you'll receive will rise along with it. And similarly, the initial principal that's put at risk is also compounding at an inflation-adjusted rate. So when your principal is returned to you, you don't get the amount you may not get the amount that you initially invested, but some larger amount. So again, it preserves, importantly, the final purchasing power of your investment. But what happens when now inflation is pervasive, it's across the economy? Now we begin to see the policy responses. And prices are rising, wages are rising, inflation targets may have been breached. What happens? Well, I think we've seen some of that obviously right here in Australia. Typically, central banks go about the business of raising interest rates, fiscal policies are adjusted, and there are ways to capitalize on those expectations as well. Of course, there, now you want to own those instruments whose principal is protected, but also whose interest rates or whose coupon rates, the income, is rising as central banks are increasing interest rates. So the simple, I mean, the most obvious choice is bank bills or a similar short-term instrument or a floating rate note, something where the interest margin is paid over some spread over the official cash rate. In Australia, obviously, this has been particularly effective because the RBA has been a staunch inflation fighter through time, and we can see some of that. Here, just looking back over the last 20 years, we've tracked Australian inflation. And when you look at the policy rate of the RBA, they've maintained a pretty healthy spread over inflation. So cash is delivering you a real rate of return of something, depending on the period, something between 1% and if you go back to the late 80s, you know, as high as 7%. Typically, when you get up to very high rates, anything above 2%, it's hard for an economy to sustain a real growth if you get over 2%. Now, Australia has, to a certain degree, been one of the exceptions to that, but that tends to be kind of the maximum level. And, of course, today, with the prospects for economic growth beginning to slow here in Australia, I think our expectation, and is reflected in the market, that the RBA is going to start to cut interest rates. So as we go through the inflationary cycle, let's take a look at the asset classes that tend to serve as inflationary hedges. And the way to think about this is that it is a portfolio. You can think of a portfolio as a combination of asset classes. But at PIMCO, we tend to think of it as a combination of risk factors. And one of the risks that we want to hedge against is inflation. But there's credit risk, there's interest rate risk, there's volatility risk. There's all kinds of risks that you want to, as you build a multi-asset class portfolio, that you want to either capitalize in terms of return or hedge against in terms of risk. And inflation is certainly one of the latter. So let's look at, you know, how assets perform during this full cycle. And we can divide it into four quadrants, and I'll cover the first two. If we start on the lower box, if we're in a period of low or falling growth and low and falling inflation, the asset class which tends to outperform is nominal fixed income, nominal bonds. Equities and ILBs are okay. Commodities are obviously at the at the probably not going to be where you want to be invested at that point. As the growth starts to pick up, now you start to see interest rates maybe on a slow upward trajectory, but growth is rising, profits are increasing. Equities tend to be the best asset class, and of course that's what we've seen really until about June of last year, where equity prices were on the rise globally, and of course that came to a sudden end a year ago. Now let's look at the other side of the spectrum. Now we've kind of peaked. The economic cycle has peaked. Growth is still rising, but we've also now beginning to see rising inflation. Commodity prices tend to outperform. Equities and ILBs do better. ILBs, in this point, now inflation-linked bonds begin to outperform equities, depending on the economy and the conditions and sort of the starting point. Nominal bonds are absolutely the worst place to be. This is PIMCO talking, so when I say it, I mean it. But as we go through the cycle, we're now, in our view, we're entering the fourth quadrant, where real growth is beginning to fall. We're coming off some relatively high levels in some countries, certainly here. In the United States and Europe, growth has already, the trajectory is clearly downward, as it is through most of the Western economies and now spilling over into the emerging economies. But inflation is still high. Certainly in your country and across Asia, inflation over the last 3 years, now I'm not going to speak to Australia per se, but in the rest of Asia, inflation's basically doubled or more. Right? Countries that were running 3 and 4% inflation are now looking at 7 or 8, or in some countries, 10 or 12. So, they're in a difficult spot, but I think the conditions, irrespective of the numbers, the conditions are basically the same, which is growth is beginning to ebb and inflation remains high. So in that kind of environment, what are the assets that tend to outperform? Inflation-linked bonds, obviously, and now cash, because we're starting to see central banks, and of course, the RBA has been probably the most aggressive at this, to raise interest rates. So a cash plus type of investment tends to work in this environment. And of course, if you look back over the last 12 months, as Peter suggested, who would have thought that cash and nominal bonds would have been some of the best performing assets in the market? Commodity prices, as we saw, they kind of bounce around. We're at the turn of the cycle. It's hard to predict from here where commodities will go. Certainly as growth begins to slow on a global basis, you would anticipate that commodity prices might come off a little bit, but clearly the demand function, I'll talk about this later today, the demand still remains strong from emerging Asia. And the worst asset class, and of course we've all felt this, probably certainly we've seen it in all the aggregate numbers and all the indices, and perhaps in our own personal portfolios, equity prices are the worst place to be. So where are we? Well, we would say we've moved into this fourth quadrant. And as we move around clockwise, we're headed back into, I don't have a pointer here. We're here. We came from here. We're here. We're right in this sweet spot right now, and we're going to come back around this way. And this is, there's not a whole lot of rocket science behind this, but I would tell you that history would suggest that these cycles tend to pan out. It's hard to judge the duration of any one of these elements of the cycle. Some countries can move through them more quickly than others, but it's very clear in our minds that whether you look in the Western economies or now even in the emerging economies, that this is kind of where we are in this cycle and where we believe we're headed. That concludes my remarks. We've got plenty of time. I welcome any questions. Please.
At the inflation-linked bonds, according to what you're saying, where we are in the cycle now, they should be doing fairly well. But wouldn't their pricing now take that into account as well, so they'd actually be more expensive to buy than, say, they were earlier on in the cycle? A and therefore the benefit would be reduced?
Well, there's no question that the prices of inflation-linked bonds have gone up over the last, depending on which market you look at, over the last 18 months, because it's been over that 18-month period that you've seen the CPI numbers come through in all these countries that leads to that resetting process, ratcheting up the coupon and the compounding of principal. So there's no question about that. But if you believe that the inflation is going to continue or maybe even rise further, then inflation-linked bonds are absolutely a very good hedge against that prospect. I mean, I think we look at the world today and we say central banks are in some ways conflicted between slow growth and high inflation. How do they respond to this? Certainly the Federal Reserve in the United States has said, we're going to put the inflationary pressures on the back burner. We're going to put that on hold. We have to address the balance sheet repair that needs to go on within the U.S. financial system first before we can think about inflation. The U.K., I think, is kind of beginning to do the same thing. Here in Australia, conditions are a little bit different, of course. But if you believe that this inflation is going to be persistent, then even today, inflation-linked bonds would be a sound investment. If you believe that the central banks are going to respond vigorously and that you're going to start to see growth slow down and inflation slow down, well, that suggests you're kind of moving out of here towards this way, where nominal bonds tend to outperform. And, we're kind of right in that spot right now in our view. Some banks will respond more vigorously. Some will not.
Douglas, just on the question of the hedge, I mean, you guys are selling the value of the hedge by using inflation-linked bonds, but are you actually delivering what you are actually selling in terms of, you know, do the inflation-linked bonds actually use the true headline rates of CPI, or do they actually fudge and use the core rate? You know, you promise something, but you deliver actually something else, so we don't really get the true hedge because food and energy is just flying away, and you guys just fudge the numbers by looking at the core rate and says, that's how it's hedged, and we don't really get what you promise.
Okay. You guys, I don't want to be cast into you guys' camp. I know that for sure. No. Let's look. In every one of these markets, the fiscal authority who issues these bonds decides which index they're going to tie the what's going to define inflation in the inflation-linked bond. So in the United States, it's the Consumer Price Index. And the Consumer Price Index, they use the core. You're right. It doesn't include food and energy. You're right. So I'm not suggesting that you would buy, you'd sell your entire portfolio and buy only inflation-linked bonds. That, I think, would be, the powers of diversification would immediately disappear. But you would take into account that perhaps inflation-linked bonds don't cover every single aspect of inflation, namely food and energy. And you'd say, well, perhaps what I want to do is have if I'm up in sort of this part of the box, this range, I want maybe a larger allocation to commodities because I do want to hedge out some of the deleterious effects of food and energy, which are not being captured in an inflation-linked, in the index of the inflation-linked bond portfolio. But there's all kinds of other aspects to inflation as it moves through the broader economy, rising wages, rising other prices that are going up, that inflation-linked bonds do, that are reflected in that inflation index. So I'm not suggesting that the inflation-linked bond or the inflation-linked bond portfolio hedges out every last element of inflation. It doesn't, simply because the fiscal authorities don't define inflation that way. And we can have a long debate as to why they do that, but they don't. Yes?
I'm just interested in talking about getting your view on where we are in the cycle, so the timing, not trying to pick the bottom of the markets or wherever, but just in context of where we may be in a cycle, how long this cycle might go for. And the reason why I'm sort of tossing and turning over this is that inflation now is something that a lot of people are talking about. I believe it's a reasonably lagging indicator, catches up to what's been going on in global growth. And now we're seeing global... I'm just wondering whether we're actually going through a self-correcting phase now anyway. We've got global, lower global growth, so that's seen lower commodities and probably going to see less consumption. You've got an appreciating US dollar, so that's going to take some pressure off the Asian exporting of inflation side. And rising wages, I suspect people will be wanting to just keep their jobs rather than pushing too far on the wage front. So, and I'm intrigued about what gold price is telling us now with the correction that we've had in commodities. So I'm just trying to get a feel for the danger of the lags and whether we're actually talking about last 6 months' story.
Right. And that's an excellent question. You know, should this presentation have been given a year ago? I think is really, I could rephrase your question. I want to sort of divide my answer into cyclical and secular. If we look at the cyclical factors, I think you could justifiably argue that we may be reaching a peak in the current inflationary cycle. Growth is slowing around the world, and I'm stealing all of my thunder from my remarks this afternoon, but I'm sorry about that. But growth is beginning to slow. I mean, it's unambiguous. So inflation is typically a lagging variable. So as economic growth slows, inflation tends to follow. So in that respect, I think you're right. And we've seen some of that. Obviously, are we going to go back to $145 a barrel in the next 6 months? I'll take the other side of that bet. But will we go back to $145 a barrel in the next 3 years? I'll go long. Because, now we look at the secular cycle and we say, over the passage of a longer horizon, are we moving into, albeit a higher inflationary environment? Our contention at PIMCO is we are. And that goes back to my first or second slide, which is that the pressures that drove inflation higher in this cycle, yes, they're being ameliorated, but they're not going away. The emergence of 3 billion capitalists in India and China and Eastern Europe, they're not going to disappear. And they've gone from simply being manufacturers to now consumers. And this has been widely reported, the consumption patterns of that large segment of the population has changed. And people tend not to go back. They tend to move forward quickly, and they tend to retrench very slowly. So the other part is that the political cycle. The political winds have certainly shifted. And our view is those don't change quickly either. So, if I look at this on a cyclical basis, I think I could certainly take your side of the argument. But on a longer horizon, our belief is that prices, we went through a 30-year cycle of declining prices, and basically prices bottomed, depending on which country you're in, between 2003 and 2005. And we've been on an upward trajectory since. In our view, that trajectory is not going to be altered by, the long trajectory is not going to be altered by, this current economic cycle. Any further questions? Well, I want to thank you for joining us, and we finished a few minutes early, so I look forward to seeing. I hand it over to Boyd. Thank you.
Here we go. I'm on there. Thank you very much, Doug. For those who don't know me, my name is Boyd Peters. I work with Equity Trustees, and we manage the retail distribution for PIMCO. I think what is clear is, from what we've seen today, is that we're entering a difficult period. We can't be sure exactly where markets are heading, but what is apparent and what is real is that inflation is with us. A few key points of what we've discussed today is that perhaps we should think of our portfolios instead of as a set of asset classes, perhaps more as inflation hedges. Over the longer periods, inflation does have a negative correlation to equities. We also see that there's a correlation between Australian inflation and global inflation. And so to that, global inflation-linked bonds are a solution to that, to hedge that inflation. We also discussed that there are some solutions to inflation, and those are the inflation hedges are leading, contemporaneous, and lagging also. This slide that we see here, really it's a thinking point and a thought point, and to that we're simply suggesting choose wisely. Unfortunately, or fortunately, there is a product flog that comes with this. I'll find the right buttons. Does this move along? No, here we go. Here we go. We've done the questions. Excuse me. We don't apologise that there is a little bit of product. I mean, it's a product industry. That's why we're all here today. But we don't apologise because we believe our solutions do offer some defensive support for portfolios. Some of these solutions include a commodity real return fund, a global real return fund, which is those inflation-linked bonds, which we've also discussed, and also a diversified fixed interest fund. Do PIMCO have credibility to discuss fixed interest? We'd like to think so. I've got with me the Morningstar tables to 30 June, and they're telling us that PIMCO International Fixed Interest, number one manager, 1, 2, and 3 years, and Aussie Fixed Interest, number one manager for 1 and 2 years. So they're on the ball. So we'd like to think they have the credibility. Come down to our booth. We'll be able to discuss and answer questions, go a little bit more detail. One of the things which we left on your chairs was this beautiful little brochure called Rethink Your Defence. PIMCO, over the last year, have been aware that changes are emerging in international fixed interest and Australian fixed interest, and so they've gone the extra yard providing materials for you as researchers and advisors. So this website, go to it, register, there's lots of information, market outlooks. There's also a quarterly outlook which has been left on the chair as well. So don't feel left alone. There is a lot of material, a lot of information that's available. I'd like to end by saying that there is always a silver lining with inflation. Part of that is that inflation eventually does fall, and if you're positioned actively and at the right point in the yield curve, there are great opportunities that can be made. So with that, I think I've been wound up, and it's gizmo time, is it?
I'm just going to hand you over to Jeff, and he's going to give you just a couple of minutes on where he thinks the product actually fits into a client portfolio.
Okay, thanks, Kath. I don't think there's any advisor that hasn't really struggled with what goes on in defensive asset classes in the last 12 months and how defensive asset class investments actually put together. From our perspective, one of the key takeouts of the last 12 months is be really careful about how you manage liquidity. Defensive asset classes need to be liquid. Part of the reason we take on defensive asset classes. And if we are moving in, and clearly we are in a higher inflation environment and taking on board what Dr. Malmgren said this morning, that it's potentially going to last for a longer time, the defensive allocation in your portfolio is going to have to be a lot more inflation aware, and the real return coming out of that component of your portfolio is going to be a lot more sensitive. In that, we are certainly focusing or recommending a focus towards real return investment for that defensive component, and notwithstanding that the growth side is probably going to take it a little bit harder as well. But getting the defensive side right, getting it liquid, and getting that real return and protection of purchasing power parity, and particularly that we've got, you know, an aging demographic and a lot more people in that post 50s and baby boomers retiring, looking after the defensive component in a portfolio construction sense is becoming more and more important, and inflation is the natural enemy. So taking that on board when constructing portfolios is highly advisable. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. All right, we can do the voting time now, so if you'd like to get your gizmos out and just let us know what you thought of the session. Has everyone got one? And just while you're doing that, I'd like to thank our speakers, particularly Doug, for coming all this way to talk to us, for an insightful presentation and giving up all your time to come and talk to us today. Thank you. And thank you to Peter and Boyd and Jeff also. So please give them a warm thank you. Okay. Have we done the gizmos? Are we ready to go now? Okay, ready to go. Did you catch it? All done. Well, thank you very much, delegates. Good day.